Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled A Conversation with Arnaud de Borgrave. Recorded in 1987, Arnaud de Borgrave, editor-in-chief of the Washington Times and co-author of the novel The Spike, discusses the early years of his journalism career as a war and foreign correspondent that took him to the world's hotspots and shares his observations of the U.S. media. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
I'm Arnaud de Borgrave. My present job is editor-in-chief of the Washington Times and Insight magazine. I've been a journalist for the last 40 years. I've worked all over the world. 30 of those years were spent with Newsweek magazine. My last 17 years with Newsweek, I was chief foreign correspondent, worked in over 90 countries. I'm now more or less desk-bound in Washington, running what I consider to be the nation's principal alternative voice. When I say alternative voice, of course, I mean an alternative to what is known as the dominant liberal media culture. As a resident journalist scholar at the Center for Strategic and International Studies at Georgetown University for 4 years between my 30 years at Newsweek and my 2.5 years at the Washington Times, I studied the U.S. media very carefully. There are about 25,000 media outlets in this country. We have 1,700 daily newspapers. We have 4,000 television stations. We have 10,000 radio stations, 1,700 daily newspapers. And there is an appalling Johnny one-note quality that seems to run through our media today. I would call it a mindset that appears to border on thought control at times. In fact, you just don't have to take my word for it. John Corey, the TV critic of the New York Times, wrote a little monograph, which I will show you. It's called TV News and the Dominant Culture. And the New York Times, as you know, is hardly a conservative newspaper. And John Corey called it TV News for the simple reason that he's the TV critic. But I asked him one day why he didn't just call it News and the Dominant Culture, and he said it could easily have gone under that title. And he has reached exactly the same conclusions that I have. And that is the principal reason why, after 40 years, I have returned to the rigors of round-the-clock journalism, to try to show that there is another side to almost every story that you're reading in your newspapers or seeing on your television screens.
Arnaud, you're a U.S. citizen, but as I understand it, you were born and raised in Belgium, is that correct?
I was born in Belgium, and I left as a refugee in 1940 when the Nazis invaded. In charge of my little sister was 8, I was 13, my father was in the army fighting the Nazis. My mother was an ambulance driver, also in the army. And we were lucky. We had relatives who put us on a freight train to Paris, and we eventually made it down to Bordeaux and on the last ship to Britain. And then I went to school in England for the first 2 years, 1940, 41. Then I ran away from school to join the British Navy. I was demobilized from the Navy in early 46 and came over to the United States and became an American citizen by choice in 1951.
You served in the British Navy. How did you do that as if you were a citizen of Belgium at that time?
Well, because Belgians who got out, like Norwegians or Dutchmen, they had a choice of serving, in our case, in the Belgian Army in Exile, which existed in the United Kingdom at the time, or a British wing of a Belgian wing, rather, of the British Royal Air Force. But those who wanted to join the Navy went straight into the British Royal Navy, and toward the end of the war, they created a special Belgian section of the Royal Navy. I served on Atlantic convoy duty, Russian convoy duty to Murmansk, and I was in on D-Day for the Normandy invasion.
In your convoy duty into Murmansk, did you have any kind of interchange with the Soviet personnel?
Yes, that was my very first experience. I'm rather amused today to see people recounting how we were all greeted as conquering heroes when we finally made it to Murmansk with the supplies that we were bringing to the Soviet Union. because our skipper, the skipper of my ship, had to negotiate shore leave for 2 days. And finally, a bus picked us up, and we were taken to a local Russian USO-type club and allowed to dance with rather buxom Russian girls for a couple of hours and then taken back to our ship. And this was a convoy of about 70 ships, and we lost almost 30 ships making it to Murmansk. Not exactly a happy one, and I was 16 and a half at the time.
After the war ended, did you return to Belgium?
After the war ended, I came over to the United States because my father was serving as the Belgian military attaché at the embassy here in Washington. He had been head of Belgian military intelligence in London after he managed to escape from occupied Belgium in 1942. And as a matter of fact, was instrumental in getting the first uranium for the original American atomic bomb. The only mine in the world then producing uranium was called Shinkolobwe in the Belgian Congo. And so I came over here, and I couldn't quite face going back to school after 4 years in the Navy, so I went straight into journalism and got a job with United Press, now known as United Press International. And my first job was as a telex operator. Then I became a reporter, Brussels bureau chief for United Press. I did go back to Belgium as bureau chief for United Press when I was 21 years old. And then Newsweek offered me the Paris bureau in 1950 when I was 24. After 3 years in Paris, almost 4 years, I came back to New York as deputy foreign editor and then foreign editor of Newsweek, and then back abroad in 1959.
Was there any individual whom you credit with having influenced your decision to become a journalist?
No, I don't think there was any single individual. It's just that as a young seaman in the British Royal Navy, I was keeping the ship's diary, and I rather enjoyed writing. So that's how I got started in this field.
What were your childhood feelings about the United States? You obviously came to the United States with the purpose of becoming a citizen. Is there any background to that?
Well, the background to that was that I happened to have been born into a Belgian aristocratic family, and I didn't share its values. I didn't believe in the aristocracy. I believe in meritocracy, which is what I try to run on this newspaper. And so in effect, as I look back at it with 2020 hindsight, I think I was escaping from my own past and looking for a new world and democracy and freedom and a country where everybody is equal and has equal opportunity, and not where you are taught that you are born with special privileges, as my parents were telling me as a child.
Well, that must have been a disappointment to them. Did you have a childhood hero?
I don't think I had a childhood... Well, I suppose if you can call being 15 still a child, I grew up in the School of Hard Knocks, as I told you, as a refugee when I was 13, and my sister was 8, and we were dive-bombed almost all the way down to Bordeaux as we were moving with millions of refugees, constantly under attack. And so I saw action at an early age, and then when I was in the Navy at 15, I saw quite a bit of action. So if you can call that childhood, yes, I did have a hero at the time, and that was Winston Churchill. He was my leader. Oh, yes, one of the world's greatest. They just don't make them that way anymore. I guess the last one that I encountered in my travels as a reporter and interviewed many times, someone who had the kind of courage that I equate with statesmanship, was President Sadat of Egypt.
That's an interesting observation. And the current scene is one in which you don't have
No, I really don't. I suppose in the Western world, Margaret Thatcher would come closest to it. This is not to fault President Reagan. After all, President Reagan is trying to cope with what we called in a recent inside cover story, our Imperial Congress. It seems to me that if you look at it in a historical perspective, for the last 15 years, Congress has constantly encroached on the executive's principal responsibility in this country, which is national and international security. So now, unless you can do something very quickly, as we did Grenada in 24 hours, it seems to me that, as democracies have done many times in the past, we tend to take the line of least resistance.
Churchill was a hero in your teenage life. Did you have an opportunity as a journalist later to interview him, get to know him?
I got to know many statesmen in my life, including him, because my job at Newsweek as chief foreign correspondent was not only to cover major events around the world, but to do interviews with world figures. And I think I interviewed most of them during my last 17 years with Newsweek, right up until 1980. And the reason why Sadat left such an indelible impression in my mind was the very first conversation I'd had with him after he succeeded Gamal Abdel Nasser. And I managed to get the first interview with him, and we were chatting off the record prior to going on the record with the interview. And I asked him what was the most interesting thing that he had read while living in the shadow of this great demagogue, Gamal Abdel Nasser. And he said, "I think the most interesting thing I read was de Gaulle's memoirs." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because that great statesman taught me that the only way to govern in this ungovernable age of ours is to think the impossible, act unpredictably, always leaving your opponents behind you, panting for breath, trying to catch up." And that's precisely what he proceeded to do. He expelled the Soviets, and there were 18,500 Soviet military advisors with 10 days' notice in July of 1972. He resumed hostilities with Israel at a time when everyone said it could not be done, that Israel could whip him with one hand tied behind their back, which was quite true. But what the world didn't seem to have factored into the equation was that Sadat was prepared to accept major reverses on the battlefield in order to bring about major geopolitical changes that would favor the Arab side. And that is precisely what happened with the oil embargo. In fact, I understood all of that scenario in another interview I did with him 6 months before the Yom Kippur War, when it became quite clear to me that he was determined to go to war to prove that he was serious about peace. Because don't forget that he had already, in that very first interview in January of 71, told me, for the record, that he was prepared to sign a final peace treaty with Israel, provided Israel returned to its 1967 borders. Then what else did Sadat do that was unpredictable? He went to Jerusalem. He went directly to negotiate with the enemy. And he was the first leader in the Arab world in history to sign a final peace treaty with the state of Israel. And of course, he paid for it with his life.
Clearly, we could say that the situation in the Middle East would be decidedly different if Sadat were still alive.
I think so. And matter of fact, we have quite a few friends among the Arab moderates, and I've spoken to some of them recently. They have, as you know, lost confidence in the United States as the world's principal countervailing force. It doesn't mean they've lost confidence in President Reagan. They can understand what we are doing to ourselves, how Congress is constantly undercutting the executive. We've seen, Bob, four key watershed amendments since 1975, which have quite literally paralyzed or brought about gridlock in the conduct of foreign policy by the United States. still the leader of the free world. The first one I remember, in fact, I was in Cambodia at the time, was the 1975 amendment, which compelled the United States to stop all aid to our friends in Cambodia from one day to the next. We ran down the American flag, which not only turned that country over to the Khmer Rouge, who then proceeded to kill 1 or 2 million of their own people, but it, of course, demoralized our friends across the border in South Vietnam to such an extent that General Giap, the famous North Vietnamese commander, when he appeared on French television in February of 1983, said that the collapse of South Vietnam had caught them by surprise because they thought that Saigon was still at least 2 years away from being within their grasp, and they had to quickly improvise an offensive to roll over the rest of South Vietnam. Then we had, later that year, something called the Tunney Amendment, which not one congressman in 100 remembers today. That, too, put an end to a covert American operation in Angola from one day to the next, one that had been initiated by Henry Kissinger and which was designed to thwart the Cuban Expeditionary Force in its attempt to put the MPLA communist regime into power. Then a year later, we had the Clark Amendment in 1976, which prevented any administration, be it Democratic or Republican, from giving any kind of assistance to the anti-Marxist guerrilla forces of Jonas Savimbi in Angola, known as UNITA. Then we had the Boland Amendment, or amendments. There were five of them. And I think if you go back and read the Boland Amendments and look behind the scenes for who was pulling the strings and what sort of hidden agenda was behind the Boland Amendments, it is quite clear that they were designed to scuttle the democratic resistance in Nicaragua. And I think the president would have been derelict in his duty had he not gone the extra mile and stretched the law to its limits to make sure that yet another set of anti-communist American friends was not betrayed in the name of political expediency.
How is this problem going to be solved? Is it a question of the president being more assertive? Is it necessary for him to demand some Supreme Court support of the separation of power? Or do we have to actually go so far as to amend the Constitution?
Well, I think that we are in the midst of a constitutional crisis, and I think that future historians will assess the current situation in that light. It is, unless, of course, we wish to return to isolationism, then I think we can rock along with our present system rather nicely. But if we're going to remain engaged around the world and fulfill and carry out our obligations and commitments and treaty obligations, then clearly this country must be able to conduct foreign policy without being micromanaged every day by Congress. We have today 535 lawmakers, all with their hands on the foreign policy steering wheel, coupled with a sprawling congressional bureaucracy of some 18,500 staffers and lobbyists and hangers-on, engaged, and incidentally, who get most of their perceptions from the dominant liberal media culture, all engaged in the kinds of games that I watched and covered in France in the mid-1950s and which brought France's Fourth Republic to its knees. Now, what was possible for a medium-sized power like France, then in the throes of decolonization back in the 1950s, is a recipe for gridlock for a superpower in the 1980s.
Isolationism seems to be a growing propensity within the United States, and as you indicate, perhaps we could muddle along under such an approach. However, if we look at the total foreign policy situation, considering the Soviets as our primary adversary, the question becomes whether our withdrawal from this contest with the Soviets is wise on a long-term basis for ourselves, and whether or not we have any responsibility to others in that regard. I'd like to explore that a minute. How many times have you visited the Soviet Union personally?
Well, quite a few times until I became persona non grata back in the early 70s. I've been involved one way or another, Bob, with 12 post-World War II summit meetings. Two of them were four power ones. I remember being caught up in the spirit of Geneva 1955, not the latest Geneva summit meeting between Mr. Reagan and Mr. Gorbachev in 1985. I'm talking about 30 years before. And there was a sort of euphoria at the time. And a year later, I found myself in Hungary covering the Soviet invasion. Then in 1967, I was involved with the spirit of Glasborough between President Johnson and Prime Minister Kosygin. And a year later, I had to interrupt my honeymoon to cover the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. Then in June of 1979, I found myself in Vienna covering the SALT II treaty signing with President Carter and President Brezhnev. And you may recall that even Mr. Brezhnev was a little taken aback when Jimmy Carter kissed him on both cheeks. And of course, it didn't take me long to discover why he seemed so surprised, because 6 months later, I had to interrupt my Christmas vacation and cover the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. So permit me to be a little skeptical. It seems to me that we have lost our institutional memory, and for most people, whether they were toiling away in this profession, the media, or up on Capitol Hill, the world started yesterday.
Well, assuming for a moment that the Soviet Union is a power to be concerned about, what is the basis on which the United States should commit its resources as the primary defender of the free world?
Well, I think that we don't have much choice in the matter. I think it was President Nixon who said once we can no more disengage from Western Europe than we can from Alaska. And of course, problems inside the Atlantic Alliance and squabbles among allies are nothing new. NATO, which was signed back in 1949 and I started covering it in 1950, I remember the first piece I wrote for Newsweek back in 1952, which was headlined as NATO Falling Apart. And such pieces have been written ever since. Now, I think the alliance is going to hold together. How much longer we're going to remain involved in Europe with 330,000 troops, I think, is up in the air. We did, after all, have something called the Mansfield Resolution back in 1971, which was designed to bring about a partial withdrawal of American troops from Europe. And it was defeated by only 7 votes. Next time around, I suppose it could succeed. But we are not living now in an age where we would expect the Soviets to avail themselves of such an opportunity to roll over Western Europe. I don't think that is the problem. The problem is decoupling. This is a principal Soviet strategic objective, is to decouple the Western alliance, not to roll over Western Europe, not to try to collapse the still thriving mixed economies of Western Europe, but to harness them to their own growing military and economic needs. In other words, to make Soviet power more relevant to the future cares and concerns of our allies than our own power. And that is why power projections still remain very important. Perceptions frequently become the reality.
For those who don't find it plausible Soviet Union is a threat to the United States, even after Hungary, Czechoslovakia, etc. Do you have anything further to add as evidence of why we should be concerned?
Well, I mean, you take Nicaragua, which is next door. I'm not too concerned by the fact that they have a Marxist regime in a small country of 2.5 million, but I am very concerned by the Soviet-Cuban enterprise in Central America. After all, while we've been debating aid to the Nicaraguan resistance during the past year, the Soviets have put in another $650 million worth of military hardware. Now, if Glasnost is to be taken seriously, beyond, of course, an arms control agreement, it seems to me that there are a few elementary litmus tests. Is the Soviet Union prepared to decolonize, to begin the process of decolonization of the last great colonial empire in the world, their own? the Soviet Union would be neither Soviet nor a union if it weren't for the KGB and the Soviet Army, the Soviet military. So another litmus test is Angola, Afghanistan. We've heard over and over again since the end of World War II that Russia's principal concern is the security of its own borders. Well, I suppose you could make a case for that being so in Afghanistan, but how on earth do you apply that rationale to Cuba or to Nicaragua or to Angola or to Mozambique or some of the other Marxist states? There is no way that you can apply that rationale. Yet it's amazing how all you have to do is resurrect some buzzwords like glasnost and perestroika. Incidentally, a lot of people think these are new words. All you have to do is go back and read Lenin. Lenin was the first to talk about the artillery fire of glasnost. And glasnost is the Russian word for openness. And let's not forget that Lenin had a new economic policy and an opening to American capitalists at the time. Stalin even boasted at the end of World War II to the then president of the American Chamber of Commerce that two-thirds of Russian technology, as of then, the end of World War II, had been obtained from the United States. We have today people, again, with no memory, talking up joint ventures with the Soviet Union as if this was something that is brand new. How bold of Mr. Gorbachev to come up with the idea of joint ventures with Western companies. Well, let's not forget that when General de Gaulle, who was the first to launch détente in 1966, when he expelled NATO from France and began his rapprochement with the Soviet Union, between that period, 1966 and 1972, when President Nixon and Dr. Kissinger got involved with détente, 2,600 commercial deals, including many joint ventures, had been signed between Western European companies and Eastern-run state companies. So there's nothing new in all of this. Again, it's a lack of an institutional memory. You may recall that Nikita Khrushchev was described as that marvelous breath of fresh air, who did indeed release tens of thousands of people from the gulag, as opposed to the few hundred that Mr. Gorbachev has released to date, and he opened up the arts. There was quite a liberalization campaign going on in the Soviet Union at the time, which was known as de-Stalinization. But Khrushchev was also the man who gave us the invasion of Hungary, two Berlin ultimatums, the Berlin Wall, and the Cuban Missile Crisis. So what I'm trying to suggest to you here, Bob, is that reforms inside the Soviet Union are not mutually exclusive or incompatible with an expansive foreign policy. In fact, frequently they go hand in glove. But there is this unbelievable naivete in the Western world that reflects, I think, an almost desperate desire to believe that the men in the Kremlin and the men in Havana and the men in Managua are no different than Western politicians. In May of 1982, I will never forget how Yuri Andropov, who had just given up command of the KGB in order to better position himself to succeed Leonid Brezhnev, who died 6 months later, was suddenly described in our media, led by the Washington Post, as a closet liberal. You may recall this. He was even described as a polished English speaker, a mean tango dancer, a great fan of Jacqueline Suzanne's novels. Apparently, he had simply loved Valley of the Dolls. He was even described as secretly sympathetic to Russia's dissidents. These are the same dissidents that he had put into the psychiatric wards that he had invented, and that he occasionally had one of these dissidents over to his apartment late at night to share a Scotch highball and to listen to Glenn Miller's records. Now, this was twaddle in all its unrationed splendor, but was printed as fact in our media. And in fact, even commented on approvingly by various Sovietologists and different academic institutions, saying that they had known this all along. And yet this was the man who had run the world's most sinister police force, the KGB, for 15 years. We had the same example with Mr. Gorbachev, who is a much more astute operator, in my judgment. I think he's managed to adopt all the techniques of Madison Avenue and then some. But when he first surfaced in London in December of 1984 with his lovely wife, Raisa, You may recall that our networks suddenly regaled us with this fatuous claptrap about the Gucci couple from Moscow that might soon become the Jack and Jackie Kennedy couple of the Kremlin. Well, I think that the euphoria generated by Mr. Gorbachev's ability to handle a knife and fork in London, and over the discovery that his wife could become the first Soviet first lady to weigh less than her husband since 1917, is typical of this naivete that I am trying to grapple with.
Well, that brings us back to the Washington Times and to Insight Magazine, which I know you also edit. And if I am correct, you see your mission as addressing these kinds of problems. The fact that so much copy would be devoted to something like what the First Lady of the Soviet Union was wearing, as opposed to whether Lenin's ideas are still influencing Gorbachev. Is that the kind of thing you're concerned about?
Oh, obviously I'm concerned about that. I would say I'm very concerned about disinformation. I'm very concerned about censorship by omission, which is probably the most pernicious form of disinformation. And by that I mean stories of jugular concern to our country that are somehow omitted from newspapers and from evening television newscasts, or buried on the inside pages, because they might change perceptions in a way that the self-appointed opinion molders of the dominant liberal media culture would disapprove of. And I can cite dozens of examples from memory. In fact, I even wrote for our paper a year ago something that I have here on my desk, not by accident, because I knew I was going to be interviewed by you this afternoon, and it's called Nicaragua, A Chronology of Deception. And each one of these little paragraphs is a major news item since the Sandinistas took over Nicaragua, which was omitted from our media. Because, as you may recall, the dominant media culture went on arguing for a long time that this was not a Marxist-Leninist regime, that there were certain Marxist-Leninists within the junta, but it wasn't a Marxist regime. Yet, on the very first day that the Sandinistas took over, 194 Cuban intelligence officers, headed by 3 generals and 16 colonels, and I have their names, marched into the Interior Ministry to organize the secret police, the revolutionary bloc committees, all carbon copies of what had already been done in Cuba since the revolution. So it seems to me that the game was up on day one. I don't think that we conservatives, and I am a conservative, even though I find it rather amusing to see that my competitor and esteemed friend Ben Bradley says that he is not liberal and that the Washington Post is not a liberal newspaper. I think that's being a little disingenuous. They say they're independent. Well, of course, we're independent too when it comes to covering the news. We do not put a spin on news stories. I have a conservative editorial policy, but I've told my people in the newsroom that they hit hard in any direction, provided that it's fair and justified. In fact, some of our conservative friends have been very upset with our coverage, including Michael Diva, as we investigated the Diva case very aggressively. So what I'm trying to do is simply bring to the attention of a lot of people in Washington, not only in political life, but in the media fraternity, bring to their attention major stories that are being ignored.
Is this reflective of a problem that citizens of the United States don't take world issues seriously, don't give enough time to, don't understand them?
Well, I think there's a, it's a sort of yes and no answer, because obviously the average American citizen today has at least 16, if not 20, problems he has to worry about before he worries about what we're going to do in the Persian Gulf, which wasn't the case 20 or 30 years ago. But on the other hand, if you take the testimony of Colonel Oliver North, I forget how many hours it was, 26 or 30 hours of testimony, suddenly there was a great deal of interest around the country for problems pertaining to Nicaragua in particular and Central America in general that they simply had not focused on because they didn't know about them. I think they understood more about what is at stake in Central America and were more concerned than at any time during the past 6.5 years of the Reagan presidency.
With regard to the press and the liberal bias, I've heard you indicate that you don't think there's a conspiracy, that it's worse, there's a consensus.
Yeah, I think it's a no enemies on the left syndrome. I've watched it at work for many, many years. The only enemies, according to the dominant media culture, on the right. In fact, it's very interesting how the dominant media culture poses as the center and excoriates anyone who does not conform to this mindset as right-wing. I don't know if you've noticed, but in our media, you seldom see any references to the left-wing and to left-wing thinking, but you see a multitude of references to the right-wing and to right-wing thinking. Thus, the message is that the left wing simply does not exist, or is a function of irrational fears on the right, and is more fiction than fact. It's very clever the way this is done. I have another way of describing it. I call it semantic infiltration. In other words, someone like Senator Jesse Helms is always described as ultra-conservative in the dominant media culture, whereas somebody like Congressman Conyers or Congressman Dellums are described as Democrats.
Interesting point. Well, how did this consensus evolve? If it's not a conspiracy, what brought it about?
Well, I think it's always been there, but probably has become a major problem since the Vietnam War, when the bipartisan foreign policy consensus broke down. And I don't think we've managed to put Humpty Dumpty back together ever since. So it's a profession, as you know, the media profession, especially abroad, foreign correspondents are very young people, and most of them seem to share a romantic predisposition for Marxist-led guerrilla movements. And it's quite extraordinary to see the degree to which they play down the Marxist aspects of these revolutions and, of course, play up the liberating factor. Or they can really, I'm not saying that this is a conspiracy, it's a consensus. They see it from a worm's eye view, just as many of our missionaries in these countries see the social injustices, the inequities, and therefore they are automatically on the side of the guerrillas, and the government automatically are cast in the light, or rather as bad guys. In other words, I think what they're seeing or trying to portray is the world as a gigantic stage for a morality melodrama, with the U.S. invariably cast in the role of the villain on the wrong side of history. And it is this no enemies on the left syndrome that led the dominant media culture to say that Castro was not a communist, that it was through sheer American ineptitude that he was pushed into Russia's arms. We did the same thing with the Sandinistas. We said it was because of ineptitude, first under Jimmy Carter and then under Ronald Reagan, that the Sandinistas were pushed into Cuba's arms and then into Russia's arms, when all of this was true from day one. I don't know if you remember, and I'm sure many of our viewers do not remember, that during the Vietnam War, the National Liberation Front was described by the dominant media culture as an independent entity, autonomous, independent of Hanoi, even at times hostile to Hanoi, and that we should be negotiating with the South Vietnamese National Liberation Front and cut a deal with them, otherwise we would be driving them into Hanoi's arms. Yet when General Giap surfaced on French television in February of 1983, the famous North Vietnamese commander, he said that the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam, which incidentally was dismantled the day Saigon became Ho Chi Minh City, here was General Giap explaining how this National Liberation Front was created by decision of the Central Committee of the North Vietnamese Communist Party in December of 1959, and that the Ho Chi Minh trails were built shortly thereafter. In other words, the whole thing was planned up in Hanoi. Yet we had serious columnists in this country as late as 1965 and 66 saying that the NLF, National Liberation Front of South Vietnam, was independent and that we should be negotiating with them. In other words, what I'm trying to suggest to you here, Bob, is that it's an evergreen syndrome.
Well, analogy between the fascists, the Nazis, and the communists seems to me striking. And yet so many people don't see that analogy or are unwilling to accept it. Do you have any explanation?
Well, you see, I don't think that as a conservative, we can say that we are against revolutions per se. Of course not. How could we be, given our own history? What we are against is the way these revolutions are hijacked, literally hijacked, by a tiny minority of Marxists who then proceed to impose a more draconian form of dictatorship than the one they have just overthrown. And then there is a conspiracy of silence in our media as to what it's all about. We were told at the beginning of the Sandinista regime, after Somoza was overthrown, that they stood for pluralism. And they even managed to con the Carter administration into giving them aid on the basis of those kinds of promises. Aid, incidentally, that was cut off by Jimmy Carter before the end of his presidency, and aid, and that most people have forgotten today, which was renewed by President Reagan to give them once again the benefit of the doubt. And once again, of course, they betrayed and broke all the promises they'd made to the OAS and the United States.
And then they proceed to close La Prensa, and yet the press still seems to be oriented in their direction. I don't understand that.
Well, today, very astutely, we see all the people who were giving them the benefit of the doubt suddenly, or not suddenly, but over the last 2 years, saying, oh yes, they're a Marxist-Leninist regime, all right. They're bad guys. We're not saying they're good guys, but we must negotiate with them. In other words, negotiate a compromise. It seems to me what they're suggesting is that we negotiate a compromise solution between communists and anti-communists. There are many diplomats who, by training, think that there is a negotiated solution to every intractable problem in the world. And we see a typical example of this in Nicaragua today. We are looking for the line of least resistance. We are looking for an excuse not to renew aid to the resistance. So the temptation is to sign yet another agreement with the Sandinistas, hoping that this time they will live up to it, as if a Marxist regime has ever negotiated its way out of existence, as if a coalition between communists and anti-communists can work in a third world country when it does not even work in an advanced industrialized society like France, where it was tried right after World War II by General de Gaulle in 1946, and again by President Mitterrand in May of 1981, when he became the socialist president of France and went into a coalition government with the communists, which didn't last very long. In other words, it doesn't work in an advanced industrialized society. As for a third world country, to expect it to work is a pipe dream.
Vladimir Bukovsky has presented a view of the Soviets, the Soviet Union, as being engaged in the export of fear, that they're in a protection racket. It's the only thing they're capable of exporting, is the way Vladimir puts it. Do you agree, and does that have some influence on attitudes in the U.S.?
Well, I would say the opposite, yes. It used to be the case, but today Mr. Gorbachev very cleverly has once again co-opted the word peace and manipulated it very cleverly, far more cleverly than his predecessors. And I think there is a temptation in this country to believe that anything that reduces nuclear arms makes for a safer world. That too is an evergreen syndrome. I will never forget it. You asked me about my childhood earlier. One of my earliest political memories as a child was my father telling me in 1938 in Brussels, where I was born, that Neville Chamberlain would go down in history as the greatest statesman of the century. And 18 months later, I was on the road as a refugee. And we all know what Neville Chamberlain stands for today: appeasement and accommodation and surrender on the installment plan. And it seems to me that that danger is coming back. And Glasnost will, I submit to you, be a formidable soporific for any presidential candidate to contend with, whether Republican or Democrat, far more formidable than the word détente was. because Gorbachev is saying, let's sit down and reason together. There's a different world out there. Yet he is not prepared to submit himself to the litmus test that I mentioned before, namely Nicaragua, Angola, and Afghanistan. They're pretending that they would like to get out of Afghanistan. In fact, they evacuated a few thousand troops under the glare of publicity a few months ago, and now we discover that fresh troops have come in.
What kind of advice would you offer to the presidential candidate who was in the line to attempt to expose Boston?
Well, I think the one thing that we should all remember is that Bismarck once said that history is quite simply a piece of paper covered with print. The main thing is still to make history and not to write it. But whether an American president can still make history in this day and age is highly debatable. And I think that's what the presidential debate should focus on. Can this country, can any president, be Democratic or Republican, still have a foreign policy worth the name? If we can't, then it seems to me that isolationism will be the only solution, but it won't be any more effective than a cancer patient with a terminal disease who is given another 4 or 5 years to live.
Soviet emigres come to the United States. I'm sure you've had contact with many of them. What is the most common concern they have about the United States and its perception of the outside world?
I think you hear this from almost all of them is naivete, which also incidentally borders on the terminal at time. They cannot comprehend why we don't understand how they conduct disinformation operations, how disinformation operations are designed to psychologically disarm Western democracies. They don't understand the process. I think Jean-François Revel put it very well in his famous Watershed book titled How Democracies Perish, which Jean Kirkpatrick mentioned in her famous speech at the Republican Convention in Dallas in 1984. Revel, who incidentally was one of France's most important media voices throughout the 1970s, editor-in-chief of France's most important magazine, L'Express, a man who had been a lifelong socialist. And here's Revel, and I think the key quotation in his book is that Western democracy may turn out to be the very first in history to blame itself for the fact that others seek its destruction.
That's this element of hating America.
I call that the plague of self-hatred, Bob, and it certainly afflicts my profession, where America the imperialist, America the racist, America the villain, America on the wrong side of history. We're always the bad guys, and we always want to give the benefit of the doubt to our self-avowed adversaries, and in many cases, enemies. And we've seen it with the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran. We saw it when there was a revolution against the Shah. We saw our media. I did the last interview with the Shah before he went into exile. He went into exile January 16th of 1979. I interviewed him November 8th of the previous year, 78. And it was amazing to see the Shah described in our media as the worst thing the world had seen since Adolf Hitler, which again was what the Texans call a blivet, 10 pounds of bull feathers in a 1 pound bag. It's amazing that Khomeini in those days was hailed in our media as the great liberator. I remember every liberal in this profession genuflecting in front of the old man when he was in exile outside of Paris at Neuf-le-Château. And it took quite a long time for people to concede that they had been wrong. But I never see anyone in this profession say, I was wrong. I was wrong about Castro. I was wrong about Ortega. I was wrong about Andropov. This never happens.
But they don't also seem to be any more careful with regard to the current.
Well, I'm not trying to put Glasnost down, incidentally. There's undoubtedly a major modernization program underway in the Soviet Union. it is quite obvious that in order for this to be successful, Mr. Gorbachev needs Western and particularly American high technology. But by the same token, he is, and he knows he's doing this, psychologically disarming the Western world. It's quite extraordinary to see that in various public opinion polls in Europe, in Western Europe today, in allied countries, Mr. Gorbachev emerges as less of a threat to world peace than Mr. Reagan. And that shows you how effective disinformation can be.
Observations suggest that the American people want to feel better about themselves and their nation. It seems to me that President Reagan got a lot of support for that reason. Is that a good thing? Should we feel better about ourselves?
Well, obviously. Otherwise, why would millions of people from all over the world be beating a path to our door? It seems to me that if you analyze what has come to this country as opposed to what has moved in the other direction, I think you have a ratio of 15 million to 15. For every 15 defectors to the Soviet Union, you have 15 million people from all over the world who want to come to this country. And that should tell us something. I think we're still the greatest country in the world, and I have tremendous hope for this country. But the only way, it seems to me, we're going to muddle through what we've been discussing on this program is to heighten awareness. I'm not suggesting for a minute that the media should be in conservative hands or in liberal hands. I'm suggesting that the media should go back to what it was all about to begin with, which is to report the news. We can all have different editorial policies on our editorial pages, but when it comes to news, there should not be an agenda. And yet there is, despite what any media star will tell you. Mediocrats, and I suppose George Orwell would have called them the new aristocrats, they will tell you this, all of this is not true. What John Corey has written in his little monograph, News and TV News and the Dominant Culture, all of this is not true. They keep on denying it. They are, in my judgment, the most powerful people in our society today and the least accountable. And something there is terribly wrong. All I'm trying to do in this job, Bob, is to try to bring back some kind of balance to daily journalism and to weekly journalism through Insight Magazine, and at the same time make a small contribution to the restoration of a muscular, bipartisan foreign policy for the free world's only real countervailing power.
And your emphasis then is obviously foreign policy, feeling that that's of a much more critical nature than some of the problems and debates we're having with regard to domestic policy.
No, I wasn't suggesting that for a minute. My field has, of course, been national and international security. And at least 30 of my 40 years in this profession was spent running around the world. But obviously we have a large unfinished domestic agenda. We have a growing underclass in this country, which alarms me. We have the AIDS plague. We have the deficit. We have the trade imbalance, etc. There are many major problems, but you didn't ask me any questions about them. That's why I've been addressing myself to my principal concern, which is a lack of balance in reporting international affairs and national security matters.
Your novel, Despite, portrayed the ends which Soviets might go to manipulate the Western press. Are there some real examples of this kind of activity?
Oh, there are hundreds. There are hundreds of examples of this kind of activity. As a matter of fact, there is a man who lives in this city who worked as a KGB disinformation specialist in Tokyo, Stanislav Levchenko, and I'm sure you've run into him or talked to him. And I think his book is about to appear. These kind of operations, as he describes them, were as easy as falling off a log. You see, effective disinformation, or disinformation to be effective, must, by definition, contain a kernel of truth around which you then weave a tissue of falsehoods. And disinformation is quite different from propaganda. Propaganda is the big lie, which repeated often enough, finally makes it believable, at least to some people that Lenin used to describe as useful idiots. But disinformation is a far more subtle process. And as I and the most subtle of all is what I described earlier as censorship by omission.
One last question. It's kind of a $64,000. Do you have a sense of how the Soviet Union can ultimately come to an end without the world destroying itself in another World War III?
Yes, I do. I think that whether it's Mr. Gorbachev or his successor, they're going to have to face up to the problem of biting two bullets. One I would call biting the bullet of decolonization, and by that I do not necessarily mean that you start with Eastern Europe, but you start with the far-flung colonial outposts. I mentioned earlier that the last great colonial empire in the world is the Soviet Union. All the other empires have broken up, whether it's the Ottoman Empire or the British Empire. That is one bullet he's going to have to bite, and how he decolonizes and how he manages this decolonization, whether it's Gorbachev or his successor, is going to be a very delicate problem, as it has been for all empires. They don't suddenly collapse. And the other bullet that Mr. Gorbachev is going to bite, and I think he knows that already today, that is the bullet, biting the bullet of a knowledge-based society. And once you go the route of a knowledge-based society, it seems to me that your system has reached the point of no return. They cannot survive. A Marxist-Leninist society cannot survive real knowledge, real information, the home computer, accessing to computer databases and things like that. Once they open up their society that way, and don't forget that that is still a society where they lock up Xerox machines at night, and if they don't bite that bullet, then they will be left 30, 40, or 50 years behind the United States, at least in the field of technology. Oh, no question about it. Stand firm until we see some real evidence that they have started decolonizing their far-flung colonial outposts, which are dangerously close to our own borders. And I have principally in mind today Nicaragua. If they really disengage from Nicaragua, then I think I will have to revise many of the things that I've said here today. But I see no evidence of that. In fact, quite the contrary, they have increased their military aid to Nicaragua in the past year.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.